From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Saudi Arabia's king to skip U.S. Gulf summit. Europe wary about British Prime Minister Cameron's next moves. UN grills U.S. on police brutality. A Latina blues singer shows her stuff. We'll give a listen. These are the stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Saudi Arabia King Salman will not be attending this week's U.S. Gulf Cooperation Council summit near Washington. The king telephoned President Barack Obama Monday to say he is sorry. But the White House says the two leaders did talk about the agenda for the meeting that will focus on better ways the U.S. and its Gulf allies can cooperate on such regional crises as the fighting in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. The White House is dismissing speculation that Saudi King's absence is a snub and will put a damper on talks. VOA's Arup Pandey reports.
Even before the announcement that Saudi King Salman would not attend the summit, there was talk about Gulf nations' worries over U.S.-led efforts to negotiate a nuclear deal with their rival, Iran. The Saudi king's absence at the upcoming summit dominated Monday's White House briefing, where Press Secretary Josh Earnest told reporters it was not related to any Saudi concerns about the agenda at Camp David.
I know that there have been some speculation that this change in travel plans was an attempt to send a message to the United States. If so, that message was not received, because all the feedback that we've received from the Saudis has been positive.
Saudi Arabia is sending its crown prince and deputy crown prince, who is the country's defense minister, in King Salman's place. President Obama's deputy national security advisor, Ben Rhodes, says President Obama and King Salman spoke Monday about the summit, which is to focus on strengthening the security relationship between Washington and Gulf countries.
We very much feel that we have the right group of people around the table to have very substantive discussion. These are the people responsible for the security portfolios in each of these respective countries.
Thomas Lipman with the Washington-based Middle East Institute also downplays the absence of the four Gulf Cooperation Council leaders at Camp David, citing their ages, health issues, and pressing matters back home. He says any hypotheses about a walkout over Iran is unsubstantiated.
None of these people has any interest in or anything to be gained by putting any further distance between themselves and President Obama.
White House officials say Gulf countries are looking for the United States to reaffirm its commitment to their defense, given the current uncertainty in the Middle East. Arup Pandey, VOA News, the White House.
Of the six participating nations, only the emirs of Kuwait and Qatar will be present. Bahrain, the UAE, and Oman will be sending senior officials and not heads of state. Reports of dissension inside the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad are on the rise amid reports of the downfall of the country's top intelligence chief, Ali Mamluk. His reported arrest comes just weeks after the death of another top spy chief in a Damascus hospital. Edward Uranian has details.
Arab media reported Monday that one of Syria's top intelligence chiefs, Ali Mamluk, may have been arrested for allegedly plotting to topple the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Britain's The Daily Telegraph newspaper began the speculation in an article suggesting that Mamluk was angry over the regime's increasingly strong ties with Iran. A Kuwaiti newspaper reported nearly 2 weeks ago that Mamluk had been poisoned, while a top Iranian commentator said that he was sick. Other Arab media claimed that Mamluk was under arrest for speaking with Turkish intelligence officials. Another veteran Syrian spy chief, Rustam Ghazali, died under mysterious circumstances in a Damascus hospital last month. Ghazali reportedly clashed with other top intelligence officials over military operations along the southern front near Daraa. Both Mamluk and Ghazali were accused of involvement in the 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri. A third Syrian intelligence chief with alleged ties to the assassination, Jama Jama, died of gunshot wounds near his home in 2013. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that the Syrian regime has a long history of getting rid of officials who have become a political burden.
Après l'histoire de Rostam Ghazaleh, après l'histoire de Il faut revenir loin avec.
He says that given the unusual deaths of other Syrian intelligence officials, like former Interior Minister Ghazi Kenan and Assad's brother-in-law and intelligence chief Asif Shaukat, one gets the impression that various figures in the Syrian regime are periodically liquidated, either by inside or outside forces. Abu Diab says the coup accusation against Ali Mamluk is unlikely, since he has no men on the ground to carry out a putsch. He points out, however, that some Assad loyalists, including his Iranian advisers, may have been upset by allegations that Mamluk has historic channels to certain Western spy agencies. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Turkish authorities have tightened controls, ending their open-door policy for Syrian refugees and making it more difficult for Syrians to enter Turkey. International journalists are also finding it tougher to cover the war. Jamie Detmer has more.
Lina Shawaf is the editor of the independent Syrian radio station Rizana, which broadcasts from studios in Paris and Gaziantep, Turkey. She was a well-known TV personality in Damascus until she fled after siding with the political opposition against President Bashar al-Assad as violence flared in 2011. She's been returning to rebel-held areas of northern Syria when possible.
I feel like I have to go there. I have to see in my eyes. It's a sense of journalist, I think. You know this. You are a journalist. I always feel like I have to feel like the people who are there. To see the truth.
But trying to see what reporters call ground truth can be perilous. Barrel bombs are raining down on Aleppo, the battered northern Syrian city half held by rebels. And there is a danger of journalists being kidnapped by jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra. But there are also risks in just entering Syria and then trying to return to Turkey. Four Western reporters were deported last week after being caught trying to enter Turkey following reporting assignments inside Syria. The Turks closed border gates in March, claiming intensified fighting near the border had forced the move. Lina Shawaf joined refugees recently trying to enter Turkey illegally. About 20 minutes by car from the border gate at Kilis, more than 500 civilians were trying to use a cross-border tunnel 700 metres long, 3 metres deep and 3 metres across.
We went there and everybody knows that al-Nusra is controlling this area. They ask about what we are doing there and then they're trying to help us to get just to the tunnel. And when we begin to walk to the tunnel, shooting was beginning over our head.
The shooting came from Turkish guards trying to deter refugees from reaching the tunnel. The refugees dashed to the tunnel.
There is children, family, small children. There is a lot of family who threw their children there crying. There is a small girl just beside me when I go down and she was crying.
160 kilometres east, Kurdish refugees who returned to the ruined city of Kobani, which endured a months-long siege by the Islamic State, find that everyday life is hopeless, with no running water or electricity, bombed-out houses and little food. Unexploded ordnance is scattered around and bodies are buried in the rubble of collapsed houses, posing a health risk as summer approaches. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Ufa.
Yemen's Houthi rebels say they have shot down a Moroccan F-16 warplane taking part in the Saudi-led air campaign targeting them ahead of a humanitarian ceasefire due to go into effect today. The Houthi-run news channel says the plane was shot down by anti-aircraft guns in Sada province near the Saudi border. Morocco's military says the jet was last seen Sunday evening and that a pilot from another jet in the same squadron did not see the pilot eject.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is headed to Russia for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin and other top officials. It'll be his first visit since relations plummeted over sharp disagreements on Ukraine and Syria. The State Department says Mr. Putin, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, and Mr. Kerry will discuss a full range of bilateral and regional issues. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg again accused Russia of violating the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine by providing aid to separatists.
The full implementation of the Minsk agreements is the best way forward to a peaceful solution. And Russia has a special responsibility to make this happen.
Secretary General Stoltenberg described the Russian buildup since the February ceasefire as a steady flow of heavy equipment, tanks, artillery, ammunition, air defense systems, and training. Official results in Poland's first round of presidential elections confirm that previously unknown challenger Andrzej Duda narrowly won Sunday's polls over incumbent Bronisław Komorowski. Final results released Monday show the challenger with just under 35% of the vote to Mr. Komorowski's almost 34%. The two now face a runoff vote on May 24th. Europe is closely watching for the next steps British Prime Minister David Cameron will take after the electoral victory of his Eurosceptic Conservative Party. There are questions about what it'll take to keep Britain in the European Union and just how far Europeans are willing to compromise. Lisa Bryant explains.
German local elections usually don't get much attention elsewhere in Europe, but Sunday's gains by a Eurosceptic party in the city-state of Bremen made news here in France. That's because of a much bigger win in Britain last week by Prime Minister David Cameron's Conservative Party. With Mr. Cameron's promises to hold a referendum by 2017 on Britain's membership to the European Union, Euroscepticism and concerns about the EU's future are back on the radar. In Brussels, the two top EU chiefs, Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker and EU President Donald Tusk, say they're willing to listen and negotiate with Britain. French President François Hollande says he's also willing to discuss Britain's place in the EU with Mr. Cameron. But Mr. Hollande says that while it's legitimate to talk about British aspirations, there are rules in Europe, including the free circulation of people, which Mr. Cameron wants to limit, that members must stick by. Before the 2017 referendum, Mr. Cameron says he wants to push for reforms within the EU and renegotiate the terms of British membership. Right now, says analyst Sonia Petrofita of the Brussels-based Centre for European Policy Studies, the Europeans are waiting for details.
Because so far the Conservative government has not been clear at all about what he means when he's talking about a reform of the European Union and what are his plans for a referendum on that topic.
The repercussions may be far-reaching. Britain is hardly the only Eurosceptic country. In France, the far-right National Front is polling strongly ahead of presidential elections in 2017, partly on its platform to exit the EU. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, along with his military chief and other top government officials, travel to Kabul today for talks with Afghan leaders. The visit comes as concern grows that the spike in Taliban-led violence in Afghanistan threatens a recent thaw in their troubled relationship. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad.
Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is undertaking his first visit to Afghanistan since President Ashraf Ghani's National Unity Government assumed charge in Kabul. Mr. Sharif's delegation is to hold separate meetings with both President Ghani and Afghan Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah. Foreign Ministry spokesman Khalilullah Qazi says Pakistan enjoys very close, cordial and brotherly relations with Afghanistan.
High-level exchanges between the two countries are frequent. And the objective of these visits is always to promote relations between the two countries, promote better understanding, and see where both countries can cooperate further.
Mr. Sharif's visit takes place at a time of increased criticism in Kabul of President Ghani's policy toward ending the Afghan conflict and placing too much trust in Pakistan for achieving that objective. The criticism stems from the increase in Taliban attacks across Afghanistan as part of the insurgent group's annual spring offensive. There had been hopes among Afghan political circles that peace talks with the Taliban through Pakistan's mediation would reduce the spring offensive this year. Foreign Ministry spokesman Qazi dismisses criticism that his country is not doing enough to help the Afghan peace process.
Pakistan is doing all it can to promote peace and reconciliation process in Afghanistan that is Afghan-owned and Afghan-led. And we will continue with this policy.
Afghan officials worry that if the level of violence worsens in this fighting season, it could halt President Ghani's efforts to repair relations with Pakistan. Critics say they fear it could also revive the spate of allegations against each other after months of relative calm. Pakistani military and civilian leaders insist they have thrown all support behind President Ghani's efforts to bring peace to his war-ravaged country. Officials say security forces have uprooted insurgent bases on the Pakistani side of the border. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The United States mounted a vigorous defense of Washington's pursuit of justice for all its citizens during a UN public hearing to examine the U.S. human rights record. Representatives from 117 countries questioned the U.S. during a hearing Monday held by the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, where Lisa Schlein picks up the story.
A large U.S. legal team fielded questions and sharp criticisms from UN member states about the U.S. human rights record. The most persistent observations and expressions of disapproval had to do with alleged discriminatory practices against racial minorities and the excessive use of force by law enforcement. The U.S. delegation said it was proud of the country's human rights record, but admitted the record was not spotless. It fell to James Cadogan, senior counselor to the Assistant Attorney General in the U.S. Department of Justice, to explain several controversial cases involving police and minorities, including the fatal shooting last year of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. The police officer who shot and killed the African-American teenager was not indicted. Cadogan, who works in the Civil Rights Division, said the Department of Justice investigates and brings civil actions to change unlawful or discriminatory policing policies when systemic problems emerge.
For instance, in March, we released a report finding that the Police Department of Ferguson, Missouri, engaged in a pattern or practice of racially discriminatory policing. Furthermore, we have opened more than 20 investigations in the last 6 years, including an investigation into the Baltimore Police Department announced on Friday. And we are currently enforcing 16 landmark agreements with state or local law enforcement agencies.
The investigation in Baltimore, Maryland, follows the death of 25-year-old African-American Freddie Gray in police custody. Six officers in this case have been charged in his death. People who say they were victims of racial discrimination and attended the hearing were not satisfied with U.S. assurances it was doing its best to eliminate excessive use of force and discriminatory practices in the country's police forces. States participating in the debate proposed a number of recommendations to the U.S. These included demands for the U.S. to abolish capital punishment, to close the Guantanamo detention facility, prevent acts of torture in areas outside the U.S., eliminate racial discrimination in all its forms, and combat violence against women. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Korean officials are worried about North Korea's first test missile launch from a submarine. Although the test does not immediately change the military status quo on the Korean Peninsula, VOA's Brian Patton reports it does show Pyongyang is working on a difficult-to-detect missile system that could become capable of threatening countries around the world.
South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-seok confirmed that North Korea did test fire an underwater ballistic missile on May 8th. He called the test a serious and great concern and urged Pyongyang to immediately stop further development of this weapon. But the defense ministry spokesman also said the test indicates North Korea is years away from deploying this enhanced capability. 북한의 이번 사출 시험은
SLBM 개발의 초기 단계로 봅니다.
He says their view is that North Korea's test fire this time shows it is in the early stage of development of a submarine-launched ballistic missile program. According to the cases of advanced countries, he said, it took about 4 to 5 years after the underwater test to complete the development of it. Still, the fact that Pyongyang is on a trajectory to develop a submarine-based missile system means it could develop the capability to strike anywhere in the world, including the mainland of the United States. This new capability would make less effective South Korea's current kill chain missile system intended to target and destroy North Korean missile launch sites. And the increased North Korean threat could trigger a new arms race on the Korean Peninsula. It could be used to justify the deployment of the United States anti-ballistic missile system called THAAD. Seoul had been reluctant to accept THAAD in part because China opposes its deployment. South Korea's defense ministry spokesman said his country is confident it can strongly respond to a missile attack from a North Korean submarine. The U.S. State Department has called on North Korea to refrain from raising regional tensions and said launches using ballistic missile technology are a clear violation of U.N. Security Council resolutions. North Korea is under U.N. sanctions banning it from developing or using ballistic missile technology. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Lawyers for convicted Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev have concluded their bid to persuade a jury to sentence him to life in prison rather than death. The last of 44 witnesses called by his defense attorneys over 8 days of testimony was a Roman Catholic nun, Helen Prejean, a noted death penalty opponent. Sister Prejean testified that she met with Tsarnaev 5 times in the last 2 months and said he expressed regret over the twin explosions near the finish line of the 2013 race in Boston that killed 3 people and injured another 264. Mexican-born and Houston-based blues singer Evelyn Rubio is a talented singer, songwriter, and dynamic saxophone player. She's out with a new CD that is also being released in a Spanish version for her Latin American fans. Here's VOA's Greg Flakes.
Evelyn Rubio has drawn attention here in the United States playing saxophone with various jazz and blues bands. But she started her career in Mexico as a singer.
I started my career singing, you know. I have been singing all my life. And saxophone came later just for fun.
On her new CD, she shows off both her saxophone playing and her vocal talents. In the sun, yeah. Although record labels have shown an interest in her, Rubio preferred to produce this CD independently in order to maintain artistic control. She says going the independent route is demanding and expensive. She has to pay for her own photo sessions and publicity campaigns.
Before, you used to think that, oh, somebody's going to discover you. You know, I don't think it works anymore like this. Maybe for some people, but right now you need to do as an independent artist a lot of work.
I met you. I knew you would be mine.
Part of her promotion effort includes a music video shot by a professional crew in New York that's now drawing viewers on YouTube and introducing many of them to her music. One of her crowd-pleasing new songs is called Hombres, Spanish for men, and she says she wrote it to counter the many blues songs that portray the male sex in a bad light.
Most of the blues songs that talk about guys, they talk about the bad stuff, you know, the cheating, they running around, doing wrong, blah, blah, blah. So, and I really think there's so many good guys out there that they deserve to have a nice song talking about them. Pero
fue así. Evelyn Rubio, seen here again in her video on YouTube, recorded her songs in Spanish as well as English, producing a separate Spanish-language CD for Hispanics here in the United States as well as Mexico, where she says blues has a small but growing audience.
Mexicans likes and enjoy jazz and blues. Blues is about your soul, about your heart, and everybody can relate with that.
And she hopes her effort to spread the blues message will help her broaden her fan base both here and in Latin America. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After repeated waves of war and civil conflict sent them fleeing, Afghan refugees and internally displaced persons, or IDPs, continue to return home, and the United States is doing what it can to help. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, Simon Henshaw, visited Kabul on April 25th to the 27th to review U.S. humanitarian assistance programs and discuss cooperation to assist refugee returnees and internationally displaced persons with Afghan, UN, and other international and non-governmental organization officials. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Henshaw commended the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan for its commitment to assist its displaced persons and pledged continued support for its efforts to reintegrate the nearly 6 million refugees who have returned to Afghanistan since 2002. He also applauded Afghanistan's implementation of its solutions strategy for Afghan refugees, agreed to also by the governments of Pakistan and Iran, to create the conditions for refugee returns to Afghanistan and incorporate returnee populations into the country's national development plans. In meetings with counterparts from various international and Afghan organizations, Mr. Henshaw also discussed U.S.-funded programming, ranging from water and sanitation to protection and livelihood support for displaced Afghans, and other programs that promote the advancement and protection of vulnerable women and girls, such as efforts to combat gender-based violence, train women in business, and advance basic literacy. The United States is the leading provider of humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan. In fiscal year 2014, the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, or PRM, provided $107 million to support Afghan refugees in the region, including their return to Afghanistan. PRM works closely with the governments of Pakistan and Afghanistan, the United Nations Refugee Agency, International Committee for the Red Cross and Red Crescent, International Organization for Migration, and non-governmental organizations to support Afghan conflict victims throughout the region. Afghanistan's future peace and prosperity is tied to the success of its entire people, including those displaced by years of conflict, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Henshaw said. The return of so many refugees to Afghanistan is a powerful demonstration of confidence in the country's future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.